Thank you, Mac. My name's Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And in the spirit of the wonderful recovery that comes out of Texas, by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and a succession of three pretty tough sponsors, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since May the 13th, 1973. And for that, I am very grateful. I just love West Texas. I love coming here. I love the kind of sobriety you have here. And I really want to thank Bill and the rest of the committee for inviting me. It's such a privilege to be here and to carry the message, as halting as it is, of my recovery in this marvelous organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. I left the bed of one of my best friends yesterday morning. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything. When I came to AA, I was the most isolated, self-absorbed, self-centered human being I have ever known. It was always about me, and it was my pain, and it was so intense, it's all I could think about. And I was sober pretty close to a year, and ended up carrying the message as part of our public awareness program in the Washington, D.C. area. We would go to churches and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ended up going there with a very funny man who had everybody laughing, and it was a Baptist church, and that's no mean feat to get everybody laughing. And when it was all over, we went for a cup of coffee, and his name was Mike Way, and he said to me over this cup of coffee, he said, "Would you be my prayer partner?" Well, you have to know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of those religiously anti-religious types, you know the kind, you know, sitting around just waiting to be offended. And, and you know, it doesn't take long in AA. And I said to him, I said, "I'm not much into prayer." And he said, "Well, that's okay." He said, "I'll pray you partner." And that began a relationship that that's lasted now, it'll be 30 years next month. And he introduced me down in Brazos River 2 years ago. And I continue to discover things about myself and about my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he introduced me, and he told a story I had never heard after all these many, many thousands of hours we spent together. He said when he was 8 years old, his mother went to the hospital and promised to bring him back a little brother. And unfortunately, the baby was stillborn. And she came back, and he said, "Where's my little brother?" And she said, "He went home to see God, but God always pays things back, and God will give you a little brother." And his little brother was stillborn in August of 1943, and I was born August 22nd of 1943. And he told that story, and he said, "So God gave me a little brother, and I couldn't talk." And Mike is very near the end. He's in hospice. And it's just a privilege to have had friendships like that. This guy who came in and didn't want anybody and didn't need anybody. And now I'm a human being that's totally dependent upon God and the people around me. I generate nothing. An old friend of mine, Buck Doyle, who's been gone for some time now from Washington, D.C., said to me one time, he said, "You're a college boy, you're a pretty bright boy." He said, "The book said God has all power. How much do you have?" And I said, "None." He said, "You're a genius, kid, you're a genius." So I want to dedicate, as I've dedicated my life to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to dedicate this talk to my big brother, Mike Way, who may or may not be there when I get back. What I have had this last week is a privilege of spending hours with him every day, and we've truly become prayer partners. And we read scripture together, we go to church together, we've done everything. And it's been my privilege to hold his hand we pray our daily rosary together, and there's a grace emanates from that man. He's always been someone who's totally dedicated to service and to doing things for others. And I would love to spend whatever time I have left emanating him. You know, I was born in a small town in Ohio. I always like to say, if we have anybody from California, I always like to remind them that that's where AA started. And just kidding, Donna. And Donna's our speaker tomorrow. She carries a wonderful message. And but I'm the eldest son and the second child in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to, but I had something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say anymore. Okay, and I would have told you that I grew up in poverty, and you know nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I had a mother who every day I let her would hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me, and I had a father who every day I let him would spend time with me, and. But I was born selfish and self-centered, looking out for number one, and I miss so much. Thank God I have memory, and I can go back and replay it. Nothing's lost forever. I can go back and replay those marvelous times, and we had some odd things. We did some odd things as a family. Every night we prayed a family rosary together. Before dinner every night, my mother, who never finished high school, would give us a grammar lesson. And remember, some years back, shortly before she passed away, she went in for surgery. And we were all in Pittsburgh at the hospital, and we're all standing around. And they had given her the joy juice before they took her into surgery. So she was somewhere out there, and they're wheeling her into surgery. And she said, "Stop." And she got up on one elbow somehow, and she said, "Boys, look at me." She always said that when she really meant it, you know. And she said, "Never, never, never end a sentence with a preposition." And the doctor said, "I never heard anybody say that before going into surgery, you know." So I lived in a home that it was chaotic, of course. When you have that many little people running around, it's got to be chaotic. But it was marvelous, but I could never see it. I had this spiritual illness that causes blindness that meant that I couldn't see the magnificent things around me, the love by which I was surrounded. My mother would, every night, our house was sort of the house that all the kids went to if things weren't good at home. And if Dad was drunk, the kids would come running to our house. And my mother would line us up when it was time to take baths and showers. And the girls would use the bathroom upstairs, and the boys would go through the shower down in the basement. And she had bins, and we'd throw our dirty clothes in. And she'd wash clothes that night, so when the kids got up, they'd have their clean clothes to put on the next day. And then we'd all be in bed. It'd be two or three of us in a bed, you know. And she'd come from room to room and read us a story and pray with us. And she loved to read, particularly poetry. And one of her favorite poems was Thomas Lowell's A Vision of Sir Longfold. And that was a marvelous story. But we never heard the end of it because she could never get past one particular phrase. It was about a knight who had it all. He had the best castle and everything. And he was going to go in search of the Holy Grail. And he was a very proud man, and he had the best armor and the most magnificent horse. And he left his castle, and there was a beggar there, and asked him for some help, and he tossed him a gold coin because he was important and he had to be on his way. And things didn't go well for him, and 20 years later he came back totally defeated, old and sick and broken, and on a very rickety horse. And there was a beggar with leprosy standing outside the gate, and he got off his horse and he used his wooden cup and he dipped water out of the stream and gave it to him, and he shared his bread with him. And then he cut his cloak in half and put him around him, and a beggar turned into Christ, And there's a line that says, not what we give, but what we share. The gift without the giver is bare. And my mother could never get past that. She'd break into tears, and we'd all break into laughter. And, yeah. Tell us the one about the night, Mom. I was also a kid with a horrible speech impediment. No one could understand anything I said except the people who loved me the most. And we didn't have things like speech therapists and things. I guess they had them, but we sure didn't have them in Martins Ferry, Ohio, I can tell you that. So I had there was a very kind nun who was my first grade teacher, and she would spend time with me and have me do these exercises. I'd wrap my tongue around a pencil and try to say words. And finally she took me over to the public library and she told the librarian, I was with her, and we told her we wanted records of someone who spoke very good English. Now, they had read records, and you could get great people's speeches and things. And so this lady said, well, there's a man named Winston Churchill who does a reasonable job with English. So I got three big records of Winston Churchill's And I go home and I play a sentence and I pick up the arm of I'd like to say stereo, but then it was a Victrola. I pick up the arm and I'd repeat it, and then I'd play it again, and then I'd repeat it. And I was the only kid in the Ohio Valley with a British accent. And I guess I have to tell you about my first drink. I think it's important to talk about drinking. If you haven't had your first drink, it's hard to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's some people I have my doubts about, but that's another story. I had my first drink when I was five, I was at home. I didn't go out a lot when I was five. My mother was away. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or something. Dad was watching us, and I was with my brother, Dumb Denny. He's a year younger. And I guess Dad thought it would be funny. We rarely had alcohol around the house because my parents had parents who would qualify to be here, I think. And so there was rarely alcohol around our house. But there were some beers in the refrigerator, and I guess Dad thought it would be cute. So we all had a beer. Nothing happened to me. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. And I remember he slid out of his chair and he's rolling around under the table and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. My father panicked and he wrestled him into his jammies and took him up and put him in bed. And I went up and got ready for bed, and Denny was singing and carrying on. He was standing up in his little bed singing and everything. And I'll never forget this. Denny urinated on the bedroom floor. And I remember watching him thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. Yeah. And, you know, it's a sad story, but Denny just never made it. You know, there are some people who have great potential and they never develop. There might even be one or two people in this room like that. But he just never made it. It's the saddest story. He grew up and did the oddest things. Then he went to one university. It gets worse. He had one major. You know, he graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing, graduating in 4 years. Yeah. And he was offered like eight jobs, and he took one. About 8 years ago now, he retired as a senior vice president in a large international corporation. And the strangest thing of all is he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old. He just let it slip through his fingers. I had to work at this thing. I was 21 years old before I urinated on a bedroom floor for the first time. So. You know, I guess at a time like this, as I think about my brother Michael and things, I guess I think about the people who've been in my life. Don's talk this morning and Sherry last night, and about the how we God does line it up and how He puts the people in our lives, and without a doubt, that's true for me. There was a woman who was a nun who was our librarian at the little high school I went to in Blair, Ohio, and her name was Sister Victoria. And Sister Victoria is one of these really strange birds. She had a concept of life that was absolutely foreign to me. She had no idea how bad things were. She would run around saying things like, every boy is a prince and every girl is a princess because we have a father who's a king. And, of course, we'd laugh at her behind her back and things. And she was our librarian. And when you served detention, which I did a fair amount, you did it in a library. They termed me mischievous. I think if we'd have had any money, I think I'd have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. We were poor, so I was just a punk. And what we did when we served detention was we made rosary beads. You know, those are things that Catholics pray on. And so they give you wire and pliers and beads and all this stuff. And you sit back there and make rosary beads. And then they'd send them to the missions. My rosary beads were unique. I spent a lot of time in Sister Victoria's library. And she used to put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was contagious. And I provoked other students. So I'd sit back there and make these rosary beads, and I got quite good at it. My rosary beads were different. They're supposed to have 10 beads in every decade. Mine had 11. And you know, in 4 years, I had hundreds of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And you know, I was supposed to... it's time to graduate, much to everyone's surprise. I had to tell her what I'd been doing. You know, you can't do that and not let them know, because it would be as though you wasted 4 years of your life. So I went to her and I said, Sister Victoria, you know what I've been doing the last 4 years? And she said, yes, you sly little prince. She said, you've been making rosary beads with extra beads in all the decades, and I know why you've been doing it. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I haven't the foggiest notion of why I do this. And she said, people all over the world are praying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that? I had the privilege of speaking at the Kentucky State Convention last year. And a lady came up to me and said, I've been saving this for you. And she handed me an obituary of Sister Victoria Shea, who died at 101 years of age. She was everything in my life, because she was the first person who confronted me with the reality that God had a job for me. That day that we talked about the rosary beads, she took both her hands in my hands and she looked me in the eye. She was an eye person. A lot of those around AA and Al-Anon, but I was a shoe person. I like to look at shoes. But she looked me in the eye and she said, you're a very special child of God, and one day he's going to use you to go around the world and tell his children how very much he loves them. And I was terrified. She scared me to death. And she showed me that on her beads she had put a medal of St. Jude, who is a patron saint of difficult cases. And she said, I've been praying my beads and every for the last 4 years, and every time I get to this medal, I say a prayer for you. And I don't know why she picked me out, but she did, and I'm so profoundly grateful. I don't know why people pick me out, but they do. And they've always been there. Mike asking me to be his prayer partner. I mean, it's just amazing things. It's things that just can't happen. Our friend Happy Harold from Washington, D.C., who stopped me walking by his table, going out maybe to die. But people have always been there, and I am profoundly grateful. I joined the Marine Corps because I didn't know what else to do. Actually, I took an inventory, and I was 5 feet 1 inch tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. That was clear to anybody. So I joined the Marine Corps, and I had no earthly idea. I didn't know anything about anything, and I didn't think you could ask. I thought I was supposed to know. So I just acted like I knew what was going on. And what I did was I'd watch other people. And I did what they did so quickly, it looked like we were doing it together. And I went over and to Wheeling, West Virginia, and went and saw the Marine recruiter and signed up. And I forgot to tell my parents. I meant to. It just slipped my mind. And didn't seem important at the time. And so the recruiter showed up at my house because my parents had to sign. I wasn't yet 18 years of age. And my poor mother almost died. She just came apart. And my dad said to me, "You sure you want to do this, son?" I said, "Dad, I've been thinking about this a long time. You know, an hour and a half I thought about it." So they signed, and my mother cried all night. I'll never forget. I could hear her in the next room, and she kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him. They'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." So with that vote of confidence, the next morning, we didn't have a family car, so we took a taxi cab over across the river to Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a Greyhound bus and went to Pittsburgh, which was 60 miles away, and it was the second longest journey I'd ever been on. And there were three guys from Pittsburgh who also joined that day, but they knew what was going on, and we were sworn in, and we had about 12 hours before the train left, and so I went, they said, "Kid, we're going to go over and have a sandwich and a couple of beers," and I said, "That's just what I was thinking," and so I went with them, and went into a bar, and that, of course, is where my life changed. Somewhere between the second and third drink, my life changed. And it changed in a way that was to dictate the terms of my life. All that fear left me. That sense that I didn't belong was gone. Everybody who's alcoholic knows that feeling. An incredible shift. It's a monumental dynamic shift. You heard it described beautifully last night at the meeting. And I knew that I was okay, and I, not only I was okay, that I had a lot to give, and I was running around that bar in Pittsburgh explaining life to people. I was explaining about men and women, about God, about the Marine Corps. The only thing I knew about the Marine Corps is they took a certain number of men down to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp every once in a while. That's all I knew. But I was just explaining it to them anyway. I made it up as I went, and then we went and got on a train. Now, that's an assumption. I assume I got on a train because I woke up on the train. And I was lying on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had been kind enough to provide me with. And someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and whoever it was, they had wet me too. And so I got up and changed clothes and got off the train, and we're in Washington, D.C. And the guy said to me, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to go find something to drink." I'd become a leader. And they followed me over. We found a bar that served booze early in the morning. And we drank till the train left. And then I drank on the train till I got to South Carolina. And I fell off the train in a place called Yamasee. If you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother. But somebody moved the bottom step. I don't know what happened, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks. And it was a very rude man they'd sent to greet us. He was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who went down there to die for their country. And I got up and I brushed myself off and I tried to explain to this cretin that he would do a lot better if he treated us with some respect. And he never seemed to grasp what it was I was trying to get across to him. They say you can learn from everything. And what I learned from that is you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from that, Jim. In case you're interested, you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. And the next morning, they put us on a bus and they took us across a bridge to a place called Paris Island. And I have to tell you this: there was any doubt about my sanity before this, this will wrap it up. I loved it. I loved everything about it. I'm not kidding you. And I often wondered why. I mean, I took to it like a duck to water. I won Dress Blues Award, Outstanding Man's Award. I mean, I just cleaned up on Paris Island. I grew about 3 inches and gained 30 pounds. And I mean, I just took off. And I decided I'd spend the rest of my life in the Marine Corps if they'd have me. And it was magnificent. And I think I discovered, after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, why that was so. You know, I didn't realize this, but my whole life I'd been a guy who'd been looking for someone to give directions to. And I think that's why I took off in Alcoholics Anonymous. because I had always been looking for directions. And I didn't realize that. I didn't know that. I always thought I wanted to do it my way. But what I was too afraid to ask. And the Marine Corps has a real clear sense of what it is they want you to do. And they're not a bit shy about sharing it with you. So, and I've discovered it. I'm a doer. That's what I am. I'm a doer. And I'm not some creative genius or anything. What I am is a doer. And if somebody says, go do that, I go and do it. And I've had sponsors who say, go do that, and I go and do it. The Marine Corps is real big on, go do that. And I went and did it. And, you know, I spent 4 years, and every promotion I got was a meritorious promotion. I came in first, second, and third in every school I went to. I volunteered for every combat assignment there was. I was in Cuba during the Missile Crisis, Santo Domingo, Crete, all over the place. And every time something was happening, I wanted to go there. I volunteered for Vietnam in 1963, but I was still a teenager. And they said, we can't afford to get teenagers killed over there. They changed their minds a few years later. But I just always wanted to be where the action was, and I just loved the Marine Corps. And what I've discovered about my disease, this thing called alcoholism, is that what I'll do is fall in love with a way of life. You know, we're an enthusiastic lot of people. And then gradually or not so gradually, I'll violate every principle associated with being whatever that is. And then I'll leave whatever it is, and I'll blame them for what happened to me. And that's what happened to me in the Marine Corps. I ended up leading a patrol in combat in a blackout. Took fire and returned fire, I'm told. And nobody was hurt, fortunately, but it terrified me. And so I got out, and I blamed the Marine Corps for what had happened to me. And then I went on, and I went to work in a steel mill, and a few months later I left that and ended up working at a Jesuit theologian near Baltimore, and I was tutored and went to school. I mean, it's just, there's a man who's still a professor at Ignatius College, but he was he was finishing up his studies for the priesthood, and he was a geneticist, PhD geneticist, and a PhD Ethesian. I'm just a genius, a PhD theologian. Genius of a man, a Jesuit, and basically took me under his wing and taught me so much. He not only taught me genetics and chemistry and things like that, he taught me how to order a meal. I had no idea what came first. I didn't know that you start on the outside with the utensils and worked in. I didn't know any of those things. You don't learn that stuff when you grow up in poverty. And he's a kind, wonderful man. And he was a man I worked for when I hit bottom. And got help. And had I worked for anybody else, I know I'd have been gone, long gone. You know, I met and, to the best of my ability, fell in love with a woman. And we were married, and we had a beautiful little girl named Kelly who had the good sense to be born in the afternoon, and her dad was sober. And then we, 9 months later, to the day, 9 months later, our second daughter was born, and she didn't have the good sense to be born in the afternoon. And matter of fact, she was 3 months premature when she was born, and her father was passed out on a living room floor in his underwear watching the test pattern on TV, which was one of my favorite occupations. And this little thing decided it was time to be born, and her mother was in a panic, as you might imagine, and she was trying to wake me up, and she threw water on me and everything. And finally, she called her neighbors who came over to help wake me up. And I was mortified and angry and in a rage, and I put her in a car, and I sped across Washington, D.C. with the blinkers going as dramatic as I could make it, and charged into the hospital where I worked at Georgetown University and demanded they take care of my wife, which was a joke, because a drunken sot who brought her there cared only about himself. And that little thing was born, and she weighed less than 2 pounds. And I did what I knew how to do. I left, and I went home, and I went to bed. And my wife called me in tears and said, please come back. Our baby's going to die. I need you. I need you here. And I was so angry, I couldn't believe it. What I understand now is there was nothing left inside of me. Alcohol had washed away all the decency I'd been taught by those wonderful parents and those wonderful priests and nuns and the wonderful people that surrounded me my entire life. And alcohol dissolved all the decency inside of me, and I knew nothing about how to deal with life. And I stormed into the hospital, and the chief resident, a woman named Mary Kate Dabbitt, and I knew Mary Kate as Mary Kate Whitty because Mary Kate was the valedictorian of my high school class. And here she is, not in Ohio, you know, but in Georgetown University, the chief resident, a neonatal nursery where my new baby was struggling for life. And she said, Keith, she called me aside, and she said, we have an experimental machine. She said, it just came in a few days ago. And we got together with the engineers, and we put it together yesterday. And we'd like to put your baby on it. She said, no, I don't think it'll make any difference. She said, I don't think she'll live in either case, but we would like to try. And I said, what did her mother say? And she said, look, and her mother's walking up and down the hall with 1,000-yard stares, essentially in a state of shock. And I said, well, do whatever you think you need to do. And so they put her on the machine. And the next 3 days taught me everything I needed to know about myself. We had an office across from the neonatal nursery. I was the supervisor of the genetics laboratories there then. And we had an office that we used because we did so much work in the nurseries. And I sat in that office at night with the lights out and the door slightly ajar, watching this little thing struggle for every breath, and watching my wife walk up and down the hallway and periodically go in and reach inside and touch her little girl and sob and sob and sob. And I knew what to do. See, my father was the greatest father who ever lived. And I know what he'd have done. Scott Lewis would have gone in and he put his arm around his wife and he'd have said, Pat, with God we can do anything. So it isn't that I didn't know. It's just that I didn't have anything inside of me. I was totally without anything inside of me. And I watched my wife go in and baptize a little angel because I didn't think she'd live through the night. And I ran down to a chapel. I hadn't been in a chapel in a long time because I had figured God out. If there was a God, God waited to find out what you really wanted, and then he took it from you as some sort of a cruel joke. And that's how sick and cynical I had become. That's how I know alcoholism is a spiritual illness. But I went into this chapel and I got on my knees before the tabernacle, a place that I spent a lot of time as a kid because I loved the concept of God being present to me and listening to me. And because I knew he, no matter how bad I talked, he could understand me. And I begged God to save my little girl's life. And I begged him. And I said, if you'll do anything, I'll do anything if you'll save her life. If you save her life, I'll never drink again. And I was drunk in 12 hours. And I never want to forget that I drank when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. Am I powerless over alcohol? You bet I am. And I later took a degree in philosophy and theology, and I studied a philosopher, a Frenchman, a mathematician named Blaise Pascal. And Blaise Pascal said God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned a favor. And I had created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick, and that's not the God I serve today. And she didn't die. She lived, and we were told she'd be retarded, and she's an honor graduate from Auburn University. I like to kid her and say, I think you can be retarded and be an honor graduate from Auburn University, but she's this marvelous young lady who's married to a wonderful young man, and he's a dentist, and she's a teacher, and they have two beautiful little daughters. And you know, when her second daughter was, she was carrying her second daughter, I was speaking down in the Florida Panhandle, and I called her to see how she was doing, and they live in Alabama, in Fairhope, and I called her to see how she was doing, and she was crying, and she said, Daddy, she said, I have kidney stones, and it's causing contractions, and they think the baby might come early, and I'm afraid she'll be like me. I was able to say to her, if she'll be like you, you're the luckiest parent in the world. And an AA member loaned me her car, and I drove 4 hours, and I got to hold my little girl. And we prayed, and we talked. And then I drove back just in time to speak The committee was a little nervous. And her second little daughter was born, and she's absolutely perfect, just wonderful, just like her mother. It's clear that that you can't live like this for long, and one day my wife asked me to leave, and I remember I was hurt, and I was also greatly relieved. And I went to where I needed to go, which was the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and I was living in the basement of a house. And one day, May the 13th, 1973, I got up and went into what passed for a bathroom. And I had a medicine cabinet full of drugs. I know this will break some of your hearts, but I could get all the drugs I wanted, and I never took them. I know it's the saddest story you ever heard, but I thought if God made anything better than alcohol, he kept it for himself. But I decided I'd take everything. And I screamed out loud. And I understand now that prayers come in all forms, and God hears desperate people. Whatever they say, he hears it as a prayer. I'm convinced of that. And I said, I'm 29 years old. At least it'll be over. And a woman spoke to me, and it was as clear as anything I'd ever heard in my life. And it broke through the fog. And this voice said, you're 29. It's just starting. And I was almost shocked awake. And I remembered that my estranged wife had given me a phone number and said, I can't help you. Maybe these people can. And I had no idea who they were. And I went out and I pulled a drawer out and I fell on the floor and I'm crawling around on my knees, sobbing like an idiot, terrified, and find this number. And I called it and happened to be a little treatment center that was started by my friend Ernie, the attorney. And he did it because he loved alcoholics. And I had the privilege of going up and doing a retreat for them a couple years ago. And there was a lady on the other end of the phone named Dorothy who had a British accent. And I don't know why I always felt comforted by British accents. Maybe it's because I the red record, but we had to run them out of here a couple times. She knew how to talk to me. They told me that they could take me in 3 days. And she said, do you need help stopping drinking? And I said, no. And I turned around after I hung up the phone and I looked. There was nearly a full bottle of scotch on my draining board. And I ran over and I grabbed it and I began to pour it out and I knew I wouldn't. But I knew if I took one drink, I'd die. And knowing I would die would never keep me from drinking. And I stepped back and I hurled the bottle as hard as I could and it shattered in the sink. And if the bottle had bounced, you'd have a different speaker this morning. What I did was I discovered the most important lesson that I've ever discovered, except that God loves me, and that is that if I take one drink, I'll die, and knowing I'll die will never keep me from drinking. This morning, I ran back to return a call that my wife had told me about last night from a young lady, and she was telling me she's sober a year and a half, and she said, I go to church and I go to AA, but I feel like I'm being called to church, so I thought I'd leave AA. And I was able to say to her, I'd say, you know, I go to church. I'm very active in my church. And I said, but you know, my church doesn't treat alcoholism. I said, AA treats alcoholism. And I said, I do get to 12-step some people in my church. But AA is where I get to carry the message. And I said, you're going to do what you're going to do. I just finished listening to an Al-Anon talk, so I had to, you know, I knew, couldn't tell her what to do. Right, Don? But I just said to her, I said, I'll pray for you. And I said, I'd be glad to talk to you anytime you want to call and talk to me about it. I said, but I don't think it's an accident that God puts us in Alcoholics Anonymous and gives us a year and a half sobriety. Because I remember a year and a half is a very dangerous time. You know, I was going to leave and go and become magnificent and be the greatest researcher who ever lived and all the rest of it. And something intervened, it saved my life. A woman intervened to save my life. A woman who had had the same experience and drank it a year and a half and was able to share it with me, and it terrified me. And from that day till this, I've never been tempted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. But at any rate, I just fell in love with this place. And it took me about 3 weeks. We came back from a meeting one night to that treatment center, and I said to my roommate, I said, I love those people. I said, I want to be just like them. And he said, my God, they brainwashed you. I said, thank goodness, because if anybody's brain needs washing, it's mine. And you know, but I discovered that if I take one drink, I'll die, and knowing I'll die will never keep me from drinking. The only thing that keeps me from drinking is the maintenance of spiritual condition and sharing what I have. I sponsor a fellow who's sober coming up on 5 years now, and he's been really struggling. I've been sponsoring him about 9 months now, and he's really been struggling. And he's one of these people who's absolutely convinced if he can just figure out and solve his problems, that he'll be okay. And the minute he gets his problems figured out and solved, then he can help somebody else. And I told him, I said, when you get your problems all figured out, come and sponsor me. Because I haven't done that yet. What I do is you get old enough, you forget your problems. But but what's happened, of course, is that I got him interested and involved with working in other people. And I told him, I said, you know, we don't know what we know till somebody else needs it. And we don't know what we have till we see someone who doesn't have it. And he's come on fire. He's just taken off. He's on fire. And, you know, I always thought that sobriety was about solving problems. I go to meetings where they'll actually start the meeting. Anybody here have a problem? You know, and I like to put my hand up and they go, oh, no. And I said, I got alcoholism. I said, anybody know what to do with alcoholism? And, you know. You know, it makes me crazy. I mean, it's like, you know, problem-solving meetings. Anybody have a problem? Yes, mother had a square nipple. And, you know, you know, 50 untrained psychiatrists take a shot at it. And you know, and people will say, well, but I go to meetings and I share, I feel better. I said, of course you feel better. Your ego's just been stroked. Of course you feel better. You've had people pay attention to you. Of course you feel better. I said, if you didn't feel better after people paid attention to you, you wouldn't be an alcoholic, you know. I was lucky, you know. I came out of treatment and I ended up going to a meeting, and I thought, now treatment's a wonderful thing. I love it. I mean, I think treatment's delivered more people to us than about anything else in the last 20 years anyway. But, you know, but fortunately when I came in, the people in AA thought you talked about principles and things like that and solutions. And I thought you talked about feelings. And so I was at this meeting, and everybody had a time to share, and it got to me, and I shared my feelings, and a great hush came over the crowd. And then they went on with the meeting. And I came back a week later. A guy met me at the door. He said, it's Keith, isn't it? And I said, yes, sir. He said, we're glad to see you back. He said, you know, he said we had a business meeting last week, and the vote was 12 to nothing. Nobody cares how you feel. He said, we're interested in what you do. He said, this is a program of action. And you know, it's true. My friend Bob, Father Bob B., always says it. Faith is in your feet. And if your feet are taking you where you're supposed to be, you're gonna get well. And you know, of course we have problems, and we sit down and discuss them with our sponsors and things like that. But you know, solving problems isn't what, I don't think, is what the program's about. I think it's about cleaning up the past, like we heard about this morning so well. And it's about then carrying the message to the still suffering alcoholic. And I'll tell you, the last 30 years and 8 months have just been magnificent. Now, there have been some difficult times. The last few years have been some of the most difficult times I've had, but it's been the most magnificent because I always look for what's inside of it, and it's always, it's truly a silver lining. That's what life, I've come to really believe that that's what life's about. People are put into my life. My friend Dick A. from Atlanta, who's a new delegate from Georgia, is put into my life. Just an absolutely magnificent, wonderful man. He's taught me a lot about faith, but person after person after person. And he said to me last week, we talk daily, and he always asks about Mike. And he said, I know I could never replace Mike in your life, but I'm awfully glad to be in your life while you're going through this with Mike. And, you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had always been looking for a savior. I'd always been looking for someone who was going to come along with a silver bullet, and in my life was going to be okay. So I learned early on to do two things, to idolize my sponsor and the old-timers, and then to help new people. But you know, until Mike came into my life, I never had a peer. I never had an equal. I remained totally and utterly isolated. When this man sat across the table from me with that impish grin and asked me to be his prayer partner, what he was really saying to me was, join the rest of us. Become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not a guy who goes there, seeks advice, helps the less fortunate, then goes home and lives with himself. I think my friendships in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's so much of the strength of my life. And I've got a lot of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I wanted to talk. I know this weekend there's been a lot of talk about death. And the reason it is because that's part of life. That's what reality is. And you know, some years ago, my mother, God rest her soul, was on her deathbed. And I'll never forget how she did it. My sisters, who are just magnificent people, had put pictures of all the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren on her wall. They pinned them up, and she'd wake up from time to time, and she'd look at them and smile. And I'd sit with her at night, and I'd pray the rosary aloud. She loved prayer, and she'd wake up from time to time and pray with me and then go back to sleep. And my brother Larry, who's also in a fellowship, was sitting with me, and we were. And my niece came in, and she said, oh, you have to come to the meeting, you have to come to the meeting. She said, my sponsor's speaking tonight. And I said, I'd love to hear your sponsor speak, but I thought I'd spend the evening with Mom. And I thought my mother was asleep, and I heard, boys, look at me. And somehow she'd propped herself up on one elbow, and she pointed at us the way she did when she really meant it. She said, you must promise me you'll always go to Alcoholics Anonymous, because those were the people who brought my boys home to me. You know, and I got to watch my mother pass away, and you know, the day after the funeral, my father had a stroke. And they took him to the hospital, and my father's just a magnificent man, and the greatest man I've ever known. And the doctor said to him, he said, Mr. Lewis, he said, I'm afraid we're on the horns of a dilemma here. He said, you had a stroke because you needed carotid artery surgery. And he said, well, we can't give it to you because you need heart surgery. And my father said, well, why don't you do both of them? And they said, Mr. Lewis, you're 83 years old. He said, well, I got to be this way for a reason. I'm tough. And so he did them both, and he lived another 6 years. And you know, I believe, I always tell the guys I sponsor, and Mac and I talked about this yesterday, that if a guy doesn't get it right with Dad, we don't get it right with anybody. It's absolutely essential for a man to get it right with Dad. And some women have told me it's true for them too. And I've never been a woman and never even played one on TV, so I have no idea what, but I know it's true for men. And you know, it took me the longest time to get it right with Dad. And I kept trying. I had my parents had never been on a vacation. They never, of course, you don't raise 11 children, send them all to college, and go on a lot of vacations or own cars or things. And after my father retired, I had a beach house in North Carolina, and I asked he and my mother down, and they had never seen the ocean, and they just fell in love with it. And I asked them to keep an eye on my beach house for me, and they lived in it for 6 years. And my mother always said, we had our honeymoon, and we had all our vacations all at one time in your beach house. And I would stop by and see Dad. I was an officer with a hospital corporation. I was traveling a lot. I went by one time, and Dad was sitting there. And I still hadn't made amends to him. But what I had done was what the big book told me to do. I'd begun to honor him. I no longer argued with him. I no longer disagreed with him. I figured, here's a man who handled life 10 times better than I ever did, and I'm going to teach him something. Probably not. So I just loved him exactly the way he was. And he told me this story. He said, remember the first day you went to work? And I said, yeah, Dad, I worked in the bowling alley down in Bridgeport. He said, but remember I took you to lunch? And I said, I don't remember that, Dad. He said, yeah. He said, I took you to Louie's hot dog stand. And he said, you remember what you had? And I said, well, I'll go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog? And he said, of course you did, you loon. He said, but you remember what you drank? And I said, oh, probably orange pop. I always drank orange pop. He said, not that day. He said, that day you drank root beer. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who work drank root beer. And he said, I explained to you how to do a good day's work for a good day's pay. My father was explaining to his little 12-year-old boy how to grow up and how to be a man. He said, I walked you down to the bus stop, And I said, "You want me to come with you to first day, son?" And you said, "No, thanks, Dad. I'll do it myself." And he said, "I watched the bus till it was out of sight." He said, "You never looked back." And he said, "From then on, you never let me do anything for you." He said, "You bought all your own clothes. You put yourself through high school." He said, "You're the only kid I have who didn't let me help him through college." And I finally came to understand why I owed my father an amends. I owed him an amends because I never let him do what he did best, which was to be my father. And, you know, a week later I stopped back and I said, "Dad, could I borrow $1,000? You know, he loaned me $1,000 and I put it in a bank, and a month later I paid him back. And from then on we were like that. You know, I went up shortly before my father passed away, a couple of months, and I went up and spent a week with him, and we had all those discussions that could never have happened if I were drinking. And when I left, I said, and he taught me, he continued to teach me till the day he died. He pulled out this old photograph, and it was a dog-eared old photograph of a baseball team, and it said Ohio Champions. And I said, "Dad, I heard you were a pretty good ball player." He said, "I was okay." And I said, "I heard you were better than okay." I said, "I heard you were all state." He said, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Your senior year?" He said, "Well, all 4 years." And I said, "I heard you had a professional contract offer." He said, "Well, I had three." And I said, "Why didn't you take them?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I had a good job in a factory." And he said, "Mom and Dad were both sick, and they needed me." And then I said to him, "Why didn't you ever tell me how good you were?" And he said, "Well," he said, "you know, you and Danny tried so hard to be good ball players. I didn't want to say anything that might discourage you." And I said, "Dad, I've been going to meetings for 28 years to try to learn to think like that." And to him, it was natural. And, you know, before I left, I went over and I held his hand and said, "Dad, is there anything we need to say to one another?" And he said, "No, son." He said, "We've said it all." He said, "You know, I love you, and I know you love me." And I gave my father a kiss, and I was leaving the room. He said, "There is one thing." I said, "What's that, Dad?" He said, "I want to thank you. I want to thank you for everything you've done for so many people, especially the people in our family." And it blew me away, and I realized that I didn't get anybody in my family sober. Al-Anon taught me I can't do that. But what I was the first one to find it. And my family is absolutely littered with members of AA and Al-Anon. And what has happened is our family, which used to be constant strife and arguing, is now every time we're together, it's a love-in. And I wait with great expectation for our next family reunion. And Dad said I started all that. Julia and I, my lovely wife and I, went back a couple months later. It was in December. Two Decembers ago, and Dad was at the very end, and I had the privilege of kneeling beside his bed as we all stood around it, and I held his hand. And I whispered in his ear that it was okay to go, to be with Mom, and my brother Terry, who had also passed. And we prayed the Hail Mary, which was his favorite prayer. And then we prayed the Lord's Prayer, and when we said amen, my father squeezed my hand and went into eternity. And I left that room, and I said to my wife, my lovely wife, Julia, I said, "I'm not supposed to live like this." I said, "I'm supposed to be down the street trying to drink up enough courage to come here. I'm not supposed to live like this. But of course I am. Because I'm a prince. I'm the child of the Father. Of course I'm supposed to live like this. This is what he always wanted for me. This was his plan for me. I took a detour. I caught something called alcoholism. When others became less important and he became non-existent, and I became the God of my life. And for years in this program, I struggled and struggled and struggled with it. I still struggle with it. I was offered a wonderful job. We've had some interesting times, my wife and I, the last few years, when things are just about at the end, something shows up and some money appears and things like that, but it's been a real struggle, but we've grown closer and more in love with one another as a result of it, and learned to rely more on God. And I was offered a magnificent job, and in effect I had it, and a man who was bitter for a number of reasons. He wasn't bitter because of me. I didn't go to work with him, and He wanted me to, and he caught up and just absolutely slandered me, and the job disappeared. And it would have been wonderful. My wife could have retired, and we could have lived in a nice sunny place, and all kinds of nice things. But you know, I had no bitterness, and my wife and I prayed a novena for this man. A novena is Latin for 9 days, and you pray for 9 days. And we prayed a novena for this man, and whatever is bothering him and hurting him and whatever pain he has in his life, that God will relieve it and he'll find a solution for it. And my sponsor, Tom, said to me, "You're not upset, are you?" I said, "No." I said, "You know, if you ask for God's will, you can't whine about the instrument." And that's just the way this thing works. And you've taught me that. You've taught me everything that I know. And yet, without you, I'd be absolutely nothing. You know, I wanted to talk one more thing. You know, the day after I was sober 20 years, my brother Terry died of alcoholism. But Terry died the way I wanted to die. You know, 6 months before, he was diagnosed with cancer. And I've been trying to make amends to Terry for years, and I just, whenever I'd come home, he'd leave town. He'd disappear. I guess it'd be hard to have a sober brother if you're drunk. And finally, my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, he had to come to that, and he was drunk, and I was able to sit him down and make amends to him the best way I could. And then a few months later, he ended up in the hospital with cancer. And I drove up, and I went to see him, and we had a discussion I'll never forget as long as I live. We sat down, and I sat down, and he was laying in bed. And Terry was the brightest, toughest kid in the family. And he was a boxer, and I mean, he's a mathematical genius. It's never been a problem for me. But Terry had this illness. And for some reason, a miracle didn't happen for him. And we're sitting there, and I didn't know what to say to him, and he clearly didn't know what to say to me. And finally, he just looked at me, and he looked me in the eye. And he said, "Keith," he said, "do you really believe there's a God?" And I got to be his big brother. And I said, "You know, I know that more than I know anything in the world." And then he looked down, and he didn't look me in the eye, and he said, "Do you think he could care about a guy like me?" And I said, "You know, Terry, the God I know and serve couldn't not love you." And then he asked me about some things we grew up with, some rosary, and I happened to have an extra one with me, and gave it to him and reminded him of how to use it, and scapular and things like that. Things that just meant so much to us as kids and mean a lot to me today. And then I asked him for something. I said, "Before I go, could I hug you?" And he looked at me and he got out of bed and he was shaky, and this one solid, powerful man, weighed about 100 pounds. And I put my arms around him. He could only hug me for a second or two. Because you know how hard it is to be close when you're spiritually ill. And then I was leaving. He said, "You know, I think I can be like you." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I don't think I have to drink anymore." And I said, "You know, I believe that's true." And you know, he didn't. And he lived for 6 months. He died the way I want to die. He died in a clean place, surrounded by people who loved him. He made amends to the best of his ability to everybody in his life. And when they found him the morning he died, he was sitting up in a chair with his feet up on a stool and had been praying the rosary I gave him. You know, I thought about that hug. You know, I was a guy who always thought I'd wasted so much time. And I thought about that hug, and you know, I remember something that I learned in theology, that there are two kinds of time. There's something called chronos, which is linear, it's chronological time, and it's what I'm out of now. And then there's something called kairos, which is God's time, which is always now. You know, I only hugged my dear brother Terry for a few seconds, chronologically, but I hugged him forever in God's time. I talked to my brother Michael in hospice before I left to get the plane. And I said, "Will we always be prayer partners?" He said, and brothers forever. And he made a promise to me, which will sustain me for another 50 years if God lets me live that long. He said, the moment I see him, I'll whisper your name in God's ear. I'm not supposed to live like this, but of course I am, because I'm one of you. And this is how you taught me to live. Thank you.